I'm glad, I didn't see anybody leave, so I'm glad you're here for more than just CE. I wish I could have had that approved for you, so it would have been a double bonus. But today, I'm just going to go through a little bit of how my practice evolved from selling life insurance with Indianapolis Life in 1985 into the practice I have today. And I'm going to share some revenue numbers. They're not meant to do anything other than give you a basis for what I'm doing and how I'm doing it. And I think to kind of couch that in, you know, terms, I just don't want it to be taken out of context in that there's a lot of hard work that goes behind it. There's a lot of expenses that go behind it. And it's not meant to do anything other than to help you if you're making a decision on whether you want to incorporate assets under management into your practice, what kind of revenue streams are possible and how to maximize those revenue streams. How did I get here? Well, that was the day of hair. But I think it's important to evaluate, you know, where you are and then where do you want to go. And in 1985, when I started, started under a traditional life insurance only based practice. I started off fairly quickly. I was 21 years old, had a 1 year old, no college education, and just really wanted to expand on something that would get me into politics. Was the reason I got into this. I mean, I was a meat cutter. Before that, I worked on the oil rigs in Oklahoma, and my career in this business started when I went in to talk to my dad's insurance agent, not the one I talked about this morning, but the other one that dad was going through an estate plan, and I said, I need life insurance, and I want to invest in gold, and by the way, I want to work for take on a third job. I was milking cows, working in a meat factory, and I said, I want to see if I could work in his Dairy Queen part-time to start raising money. And he looked at me and said, rather than do three jobs poorly, why don't you do one job well? And I took the test, scored well, and started 3 months later in April 1st of 1985, just celebrated my 30th year. And I tell that story because we're always conflicted in what do we do well? We're a disability specialist, we're a pension specialist, we're a life insurance specialist, we're a buy-sell specialist, where a lot of things, what I find in talking to advisors, we wear a lot of specialist hat. But are we really a specialist? And I found early on that the firm I work with gravitated towards qualified retirement plans. And we had an affiliation with the Indianapolis Life Insurance Company. They were a TPA. My sister-in-law did all the record keeping. The other gentleman was an attorney. He did the legal work on the documents, and I just called on everybody. So we built up a nice little practice, and over the years, that had been the genesis of how my practice started, 401k-based asset accumulation, and then started picking up assets on the side. Now, we are starting to phase out of the 401k world in light of what's going on with the DOL rulings where the IRA rollover days for a 401k advisor, I think, are quickly coming to an end. If you've read any of the regulations, if you're the 401k advisor, I think you're going to be stuck with those assets in the 401k, and you're going to have to refer out that rollover to somebody else. It's personal opinion, but it's what happened in Australia. It's what happened in the United Kingdom. And they made the pension specialist specialize only in the pension work, and they made the investment specialist. And there is separation of those two. And I think that will be the U.S. model. Hope not. But in recognition of that, we started building up assets under management. And that's going to be my story today. So please stop me if you have any questions on things that I bring up. This is a conversation. It's not a lecture. So why? Why assets under management? It's not about the money, but I think it's about the potential. There's a transition right now, as I look at it, as the baby boom generation gets older, they're pushing the money with them. I mean, they've pushed money along with them. They pushed offerings with them. So as the population ages, There's fewer of us now than there was in this business a number of years ago. So there's more assets than there's ever been. Why? Because it's easier. The aging population needs advice. The regulations are changing. A lot of the people who are at the towards the end of their career are finally going to get tired of the paperwork, and they're going to be retiring en masse. The people under age 50, I think, have the best opportunity in the world to team up with people over age 65. So I think there would be a lot more asset management taking place if people didn't have to worry about the regulations. Lifestyle changes. Even though there's access to information everywhere, there is very little knowledge and wisdom, and I'll talk a little bit more about that later. But just lifestyle changes. People don't want to mess with it. They don't like watching their own money. Mature life insurance market. We have a lot of people that own life insurance, and it's tough to find that new sale. A lot of it's additional sale or rollover sales. But in a mature life insurance market, you have to add extra value and use that life insurance very creatively. Robo-advisors. That's a key word right now. A few years ago, it was something else. A few years before that, it was something else. I got interviewed from a reporter in the United Kingdom about robo-advisors, and was MDRT worried about robo-advisors? And I said, are they worried about robo-doctors? I said, you can go on WebMD and diagnose anything you want to. But I said, it's still going to require somebody to look at the hard facts and make a judgment decision with the brain. A surgeon needs to know where to cut. The x-rays are available to anybody. But the surgeon's going to look at the situation on the ground. Once the first cut gets open and you look at the internals, then you know where to make the second cut. It's the second cut that's most important, not the first cut. Same thing with financial advice. People can go on, create an allocation anywhere, any time of the day. But it's still going to require a human to evaluate the physical aspects of the facts on the ground. Do they have too much debt? What's the credit card need? What's the cash flow need? Is that child going to go to a state college or a different college? All those things require a human. Robo-advisors will create more business for those of us that get good at what we do than they will take away from us. It's like buy term and invest the difference. How many of you have converted all that term insurance over the years into a good, solid life insurance portfolio? Recurring revenue, from our standpoint, I can do what I do today because I know what my recurring revenue will be next year. We take on 12 to 15 new clients a year. We set minimums where I could never do that before. And the more exclusionary that I've made my practice, the more people want to do business with us. So we brought in junior advisors to help people that don't meet the other asset criteria. But the recurring revenue allows me to do this. And creating value in your practice. I've purchased 7 practices now. The ones that pay, that I write the biggest check for, are the ones that have the largest recurring revenue. If you go to Moss Adams and do a valuation, or if you go to EF Advisor, there's a valuation firm. Recurring revenue gets a 2 to 2.3 multiple. So if you have $100,000 of recurring revenue annually, the value of that income stream is about $230,000 to $250,000. If you have $100,000 of sales revenue, your practice is worth about $75,000. Recurring revenue builds up value in your practice. So for the standpoint of the advisor, there's a lot of benefit in that. The other thing is, I position myself to get paid for my value. And we all know you can make a lot of money with sales skills, but I want to get paid for my knowledge. So we've created systems in our office that are replicable, but almost seem to be proprietary by us. And I want to spend most of my time adding value and wisdom to my clients. If you want to make $1 million a year in this business, I think it's important to realize what it takes to do that. If you're in a product-based sales practice, you got to sell a lot of product to a lot of people, so it's a transactional business. Top of the table guys, on average, sell about 280 policies a year. An MDRT member sells about 1/6 of that, about 75 policies a year are the statistics. That's not quite right, but it's about 75 a year for an average MDRT member, about 280 a year for a top of the table member. You have to do a lot of transactions, and I'm going to refer to those firms as early solos. Those are people that, whether you work in an office of 20 people or not, your practice is basically you and a staff person. You're selling products, you're doing quick transactional things, maybe a little bit of advanced advice for the bigger clients to get the bigger cases. But in order to make that million, you have to do a lot of volume. And you hit a point, you hit a complexity point. You're either working more hours, there's more time in your day spent doing it, but the only way you can make more is if you sell more. The next iteration of a practice is a sales-based practice. It's called mature solo. Those are a traditional insurance agency. Maybe you have two or three people that team together. Three solos come together, you make a practice. But again, the combination of the three, maybe you have a pension specialist, a DI specialist, and you combine your talents together. And that joint work helps increase your income. A service-based model, that's a pension-based model or a recurring financial services-based model. Again, you're building value and you don't have to do as much because your clients become bigger or your processes become bigger. Instead of doing a one-on-one sale, you're selling to a factory, doing multiple life sales, and you're still selling one time, but you're impacting hundreds of lives. A value-based mature ensemble, that's the enhanced planning firms. That's where you do the asset management. You have an asset management division, you have a couple of other divisions, and again, there's combinations and efficiencies in the scale. And the top one is where you get paid for your wisdom. That's where you determine who you want to talk to, not trying to find somebody that'll talk to you. People come to you and your firm because you're standout in what you do. You're known professionally in the professional world, and you're paid according to your wisdom, whether you sell a product or not. You're paid based upon your performance under assets under management, and you add the value. And you look in examples in sports, a lot of guys have talents. LeBron James has talent. Michael Jordan had talent. But they were made better by the people they surrounded themselves with. Alone, they would be okay, but their highest in net worth not only came from them being good, but they were good with other people at the same time. And that's where we've tried to develop our practice growth into, is to take the emphasis off of me, let me focus on the clients and the prospecting and the marketing that will bring in that client 10 years from now. When I do meet with clients, we're adding a level of wisdom that we think is not out there. Now, again, other people can put together parts, but my clients come to me not because I'm brilliant, but because I can get them in touch with brilliant people. I tell people my database of clients and networking is the most valuable thing I have for you. The products can be purchased by anybody, from anybody. But it's my network of people in my client base, my successful business owners, that will get you that generator on Saturday night when your house goes dead before your party. Call me and I'll get the generator there, because I've got a client that does that. It's getting your plumbing fixed when your house inspection is coming. Those are all actual things that we've done for clients, and I think that's the reason people do business with me. It's not that my portfolio management is spectacular. It's because I can do things that other advisors choose not to do. And the margins are tougher. When you get in the product-based world, margins are crashing down. Targets, it's a tough world. So you sell more and you make less of it. There's pressures from the web. There's pressures from everything. So again, the only way to make more is to do more. You have to physically be involved in it. Sales-based practices, medium margin, volume, and people-based. You got to hire more people if you're going to do more if you're in that model. Service-based model, again, you're in the advanced marketing organizations, but what will make you better will be technology and people-based. Value, if you're adding value to your clients in that type of firm, you're a high-margin, advice-based. And again, the wisdom base, as I look at it, it's total planning. It's not product-based, and you have to take yourself out of the product sale. And literally every single client that walks in is, what can I help you with today? Not which product can I help you with today? And that took a long time for me to make that transition. I come from an insurance-based world in which I promised guarantees. I guaranteed if you die, there'll be a check. If you become disabled, there'll be a check. To the world in which I invest money for people, and there is no guarantees outside of the insurance-based variable annuities. It took a long time for me to realize that my clients still had that investable money with a big brokerage house or another advisor, but they didn't have the trust level in them. So I didn't promise them any more guarantees, but I was able to complete that relationship of trust and then manage their assets very effectively. So once I got out of the mindset that it's okay to lose money, and or got into the mindset that it's okay to lose a little bit of money because the market will control that, not the advisor. I can only help them position it correctly so that they do make it right. That's when our asset-based sales really, really increased. This came from a Moss Adams study, and I spent a lot of time with a consultant in Seattle by the name of Philip Polyviv. And Philip used to work for Moss Adams and then went off on his own. And he's been one of the biggest guidance for me and my firm in how we have structured it, how we've built our recurring revenue model, how we've backed up the documents, and how we've acquired firms. And these are just industry statistics on the different models. So sales base, early solos are about 130, this is based on a 2012 study, about 133,000, mature solos, 218. Early ensembles, about the same. But it's where you start thinking in terms of a firm versus the individual is where the value and the revenue of the firm increases. And it increases in revenue per client. I used to think about commissions based upon a sale and how much would I make off of the sale. Now we think about the recurring revenue generated as we evaluate our clients. So I'm just as eager to deal with somebody where I make a recurring revenue stream that we can afford to service them. And we set a target of $5,000 of recurring revenue as a minimum to see me. We like them in the 10s, 15s, but in our marketplace of 3,000 people, that's the people we want. And if you do them, yeah.
Is that an annual recurring income?
Yes, yes. So as you look at the difference, and this is where the light bulb went off for me. When I started, I asked about annuities, and back in the day I sold a couple of annuities my first 2 years, they were paying 12% guaranteed for 10 years. Ohio National had one, sold six or seven. I wish I would have sold 1,000 of them. But at that time, we were competing against everything else going on out there. And there were bonds and there was this and that. And I asked my general agent why we weren't selling more at that time. He said, they only pay 3% commission and you only get paid once. Why would you ever do anything like that? He looked at it, what they were making, what the commission was on it, and that's what based his sale. As you heard Steve say this morning, we as an industry have to really rethink that. A few years later, I found out through my own clients that no matter what product you have, money circulates about every 6 or 7 years. Not by choice, but by things happen in people's life. So those annuities I sold with a 12% doubled very quickly. rule of math, they put in 100,000. They soon had 200,000 in there, and then they matured. The 10 years were up. And that's when the lesson kicked in for me early, is that I was building wealth, and as I built that wealth, I didn't have to seek another $200,000 prospect. It just matured, came out of surrender, and we had to find something else. So as these annuities, which we started with, started maturing, we started looking at building mutual fund portfolios and then building asset advisory on top of it. But that's what you find here, is these market dominators aren't seeking and aren't really acquiring new practice, new prospects. What they're doing is getting more and more revenue off of their existing clients and taking on enough new clients to keep the growth going and to cover the 2 or 3% that leave every year. So to get from this, you have to do the math back into what your model involves. If you're selling $100,000 of life insurance and it has a $4,000 premium, you can do that under a sales-based organization. But if you want to make $200,000 a year, you have to have 100 of those. And if you want to make $400,000 a year, you have to have 200 sales. What we look at and what mature solos look at is, can we bring somebody into the firm that we can give the services needed so that they'll willingly pay us the $12,000 a year or $10,000 a year and still feel like they've got great value? So it's not who can we sell, who can we help? And that's the mindset shift that becomes very important if you're going to get into the asset management. What's our process? What do we deliver to our clients? What do we do differently that the big firms don't do? I don't really know what other firms don't do. I have in a town of 3,000, I have a property and casualty agent that I compete against, and I've got an Edward Jones guy. Edward Jones guy sells mutual funds, that's all he does. He says he does everything, he sells mutual funds. Every day he sells mutual funds. We look at it as we're the access to our client's wisdom. And part of my approach when I bring in a new client, one of the opening statements I make is, you can do what we do on your own. You don't have to have us. But our clients choose to pay us well because we bring you the wisdom of getting you your money when you need it most. Markets go up, markets go down, but we'll be here to help make sure you're at the right spot at the right time in your life. So we talk about access to wisdom with our clients. We developed a proprietary strategy we call Apple. And in our early discussions, we talk about there's a simple process that we've developed to help our clients invest their money. It's called Apple, A-P-P-L-E. There are two styles of management out there right now. If you talk to Vanguard disciples, they believe in index funds, don't pay for management. And then you've got the management people who say, we bring performance. And if you've done any studies in the market, one will do well, the other one won't do so well. The other one will do well, and the other one. But they seem to teeter-totter back and forth. My argument is, let's do both. So the first A in Apple, we put about a third of their assets into. And about a third of the time, active management actually outperforms passive. And that's the second one, passive. So we'll use active managers. We'll use a mutual fund portfolio. We'll buy access to private managers. Active management, take a very aggressive approach. Passive, a third of our portfolio goes into ETFs. We just keep them in there. We monitor the mixture, but a third goes into passive. And then there's a third of the time, when those two both do horrible, that we use protected. And we use mostly variable annuities with an income rider guarantee, or if they have their amount that they need in a, like, let's say a pension income, or if they've got an adequate Social Security, we'll use guarantee-based products. CDs at a bank, more stable value. So it's a concept people understand. And you can develop that inside of your own. We copyright, call it the Fred plan. I don't care what you call it, but that's what we did. And then the LE in Apple stands for legacy. And it's very similar to the presentation you heard today, where we scrape off some of this excess growth from time to time, and we put it into a life insurance-based product so that you can't outlive your money. So that there'll be money there for a legacy for your children or for your spouse in case you die. We protect the nursing home stay. We protect all of those different things with your legacy plan. That's my discussion with clients. Once I get through that, there's a process behind it, which I found is the most important thing, is people want to know that you have a process. It's just not throwing darts. They don't want to know that you'll get them out of the market at the right time. They don't want to know that you'll put them in at the right time. They just want to know that you have a process. And a statement I've used time and time again is this, you know, you hear it right now. Is this the right time to go into the market? Are we in a, you know, beginning of a bear market? I said, I can't control when the market's going to go down, so I recommend you put your money in, and I'll do well if you can let me pick when we get out. Because when you get out of the market is more important than when you get in. If you have the flexibility and the time allocated to pick when they get out, so we spend a lot of time on time horizons. When do we need to turn this into an income stream? When do you need to get out? That statement has helped me acquire more clients than anything else because they get it. I can't predict what the market's going to do tomorrow. When I first started this process, I thought I had to. I can't predict the future. But if I'm sitting there with a 15% portfolio gain and they'll let me pull out to match a liquidity need they have in the next year and a half, I'm a genius because I can look backwards on performance. So a statement I use often with my clients, I don't know if it's the right time to get in. I can't predict when is the best time to get in. But if you give me the ability to pick when you get out, we can determine your success. Core reporting. We use eMoney platform. Does anybody else use eMoney? eMoney is an aggregation software. They just sold out to Fidelity, and we just had a person come in. We customize that and we call it our core reporting, sticking with the Apple theme. It's the core, it's what holds it all together. And that's another thing you'll find. We brand everything. We stole that from Dan Sullivan. We own these processes. Well, you can own the processes too, but when you come into my office, you get my processes. And what I found is people think that you've invested the time in this process to do the research. But we can buy the research. We can buy the eMoney platform. And eMoney is a needs analysis. It's a portfolio analysis. But it gives you the ability to charge what you're worth. Because it'll help you do evaluations on their estate planning. You can allow access to the accountants. The accountants love that when they can pull up and become part of the process. And it helps you get more value into your charging approach and your revenue approach. Income basket approach, income for life. Anybody use that concept? We have we call it the six baskets of income distribution success, and it's a simple concept that you take people's money and you divide it into six baskets, 5-year increments. So if they're 60 years old, this money will last for 30 years, and it builds on the Apple approach. But basically, people hate the concept of putting their money in right before the market crashes. So what we do is in the first basket, we say we're going to put whatever it takes to give you 5 years of income. If you need $30,000 a year, we're going to put $150,000 of your money in that first basket. And it's going to be CDs, it's going to be money market, it's going to be liquid, it's going to get 1% return. The second basket, which is for years 6 through 10, we're going to put that in a little bit more aggressive. So we're going to shoot for 3% return. And because it'll time value of money, we're going to put about $120,000 in there. So we've got 10 years of income locked up no matter what the market does. And then I go back through history. Has there ever been a 10-year time in which the market has ever not performed more than 10-year period? And there's only one through the 1940s. So I said, are you willing to give me the option of taking 10 years? And even in that 1940 decline, there was a couple of spikes in there. So we take 10 years and lock it up in very simple things. I haven't adjusted to the Tom Hegna guarantee income into an annuity approach. It's just, there's some things that we don't do with that. But then that gives me the ability to invest baskets 3, 4, 5, and 6 in a combination of annuities, full aggressive mutual funds, platforms, the Apple, the A and the P and the Apple. But there again, that helped me overcome the biggest fear I had, which is to invest people's money and then the market goes down the second or third year. If I know I've got a place for them to go for the first 10 years, I can think more strategically. Follow-up servicing. Once we get a client, those are our three basic approaches that we have them come in. We identify our clients. I'm going to give you some some input on how to identify your clients. A-plus clients get 72 touches a year. We're contacting them 72 times a year. It sounds like a lot, but they get a weekly personalized email from us every week. So 52 touches right there. They get quarterly phone calls just to touch in, see how they're doing. They can access us anytime, but we reach out to them. And we've only got about 45 A-plus clients, so it's not a big deal. A lot of my staff handles that. A clients get about 60 touches a year. We just don't reach out as often. We do it on a quarterly or semi-annual basis. B clients, they don't get access to me at all. They just get my partner or paraplanner. C and D clients either get staff or the paraplanner. And most of our D clients are legacy clients that bought a policy and just never wanted to do anything more with us. We've got about 2,500 total policy holders, but we manage assets for about 190. And then I work with the top probably 75-ish plus my 401k clients. And that's the other thing I found is the division of my time helped us give better service. If I can tell people that they're exclusive, they appreciate that. They can be exclusive with any agent. But a lot of times if you walk in, the biggest problem I've seen with a lot of advisors is they treat almost all their clients the same level of service. They don't hold anything back for only the best, except ball tickets and those type of things. But if you tell them they get A-plus clients, get access, plus they get all the e-money and all the other core things included in their revenue stream, then it's easier to get a lot of them to stay with you. Yeah?
What are you basing your segmentation on? Are you basing it on asset level?
Let me show you. Asset and revenue and potential. That'll be one of the slides coming up here just quickly. And I'm running out of time. So start with the current clients. If you want to get into the asset management business, you probably have a book of business in your existing clients that you haven't touched. And if you don't want to do it, I recommend you team up with somebody that can. Somebody that you trust, somebody that you like, that likes the asset management side of things, and figure out a way to work together. Create a business plan. It doesn't just happen. Put together a business plan, just like you would if you were creating the next Microsoft or starting up a brand new internet company. You got to have a business plan. So what's your business plan for this? Just simply writing one down. If you contact me, I'll give you access to a couple ways to do that. Identify client needs. What are your current clients needing from you? Are they in the distribution phase? Are they in the small business phase? I'll tell you, small business owners don't have a lot of investable cash. That was my marketplace outside of their 401k plans. So I started with the 401k plans, and then as they matured, they started accumulating a lot of assets, investable assets. And I became very good at telling them, pull some of those resources out of your company and protect it. What are your strengths? What are you good at? Are you a good money manager? If not, team up with SEI. Team up with a big money management firm that does it for you, and you focus on the relationships. It's not that you have to have an Apple plan, but you should have something that you can get excited about, and most every company has an asset management portfolio. What are your market strengths? Are you in a physician's market? Are you in a retiree market? Determine that, and then what is your market area? My market area is 15,000 people. I have more assets under management than the three banks in town. But I drive a lot. I mean, I cover about 55,000 miles a year in addition to my flying. I spend a lot of time in a car. So I can't expect a client that's 3 hours away to drive down to my office. So I visit them a lot. Okay, so here's the ranking formula. And if you give me your card or your email, it's small. But recurring revenue, this is one that's developed by Philip Polaviv through my broker-dealer. You give them scores. It can be whatever you want it to be. It doesn't have to be these numbers. But this was the starting point. It's an Excel spreadsheet. It's proprietary to NFP, but give me your card. I'll shoot you an email with it. Transactional revenue. So not only what is their recurring revenue range, what's the transactional revenue? Revenue potential. That's the biggest one to evaluate honestly. We all think they have a lot of potential, but what's the hard facts on the ground? And we've actually let clients go or drifted them down in their service level because they're absorbing a lot of time. I have a legacy client right now, one of the five richest people in this community, and we got to let him go. He is killing us, and he's not buying anything new. And it's a legacy policy, so I'm going to find a young agent that wants to work with him, but we just can't give him the level of service he needs based upon the zero amount of revenue he's giving us. His potential is great. He's got a lot of money, but he's not able to be developed. So you got to know when to let clients go as well. Actual referrals, have they given you any business? Quality of relationship, again, look at your clients honestly when you rank them. Do you like working with them, or you dread when they call in? We fired clients for yelling at our staff. We just don't tolerate it. And as such, I have some very nice clients, not because they were anything other than nice people that I wanted to work with. Network potential, you know, are they involved in something and required time to service? This is another one. I had my staff go through all of our clients, the top, I think it was 500, and we evaluated the time servicing these people. Some surprises in there. That's where this one popped up that I thought he was a good potential client. Maybe someday he's going to do something, his family, his kids. We're letting him go. Then you score them. So, you know, if they get a 90 to 100%, exceptional clients, or I call them A-plus clients, and then, you know, just adapt your own scoring level. So it really, in order to rank your clients first, and then you find out you drift up and make the clients that are your A-plus clients know, let them know you're A-plus clients. You don't want to tell a D client they're a D client, but you definitely want to share that the A-plus client is getting all the extra services. And then again, take all this out, it gives you a ranking percentile. This is what we've used. If you need something, yes, I'll help you out.
How often do you go back and re-rank them?
About every 3 years. We're on our fourth iteration of this right now since 2006. So we've done it as we've acquired clients and acquired firms. We merge them in, get a feel of who they are, and then we re-rank them. So we're right in the where we have a staff meeting. All staff meeting next week, and this is one of the projects that we're going to introduce and assign duties. So, transition. It's not easy. You're good at what you do. You're making money right now. You don't want to jump shop. You maybe have a company relationship that is an insurance base, and I'm not saying that this is the cure-all to end-all. But in most companies right now, you know, State Farm's got a big push on right now to become total financial planners. And they have the legacy of servicing hundreds and hundreds of homeowner policies and car policies. And if State Farm can do it, anybody can do it. That's a testament to the power of the potential in my mind. So, slow transition. You heard about my financial issues, and we started this process in about 98, 99 is when we started doing it in our 401k plans, where we took it more from an upfront emphasis to a recurring revenue emphasis. And in about 2004, 2005, I was just about ready to give up on the recurring revenue emphasis because I couldn't afford it. I needed revenue today, not 10 years from now. And I got a tip from a wholesaler with an annuity company that changed my entire outlook on the quest. He says, Brian, you don't have to do it overnight. He said, you started this process a few years ago, keep going. But here's how I recommend you do it. We were doing a lot of annuity-based business back then. And he said, annuities have an upfront commission or a trail commission. It makes no difference to the client. He said, you don't have to do them all on trail. He said, why don't you sell 2 or 3 out of 4 up front and take 2 trail? Do that for a year or two, then flip it. Take 2 out of 3 trail, 1 up front, and he said, then after about 6 or 7 years, go completely trail. And it was a flash of the brilliant obvious that made me think about everything we did. We were in upfront mutual funds also, a lot of, you know, taking in and taking the A shares because we were told that was the best thing to do. Instead of taking 1% a year under assets under management, we thought we had to sail up front. And I needed the cash flow. But that put everything else into work for me. And that's what we did. We are completely out of everything we can get out of upfront loads. And we are completely backloaded now. And our recurring revenue has matched dramatically that move. But you don't have to do it all at once. Life insurance is still an upfront world. We still sell a lot of life insurance, and it didn't diminish my life insurance sales. It's just that the recurring revenue is a bigger revenue stream. A couple of ideas that we did to get into that, I call it 100-to-1 marketing. Find groups that you can approach or centers of influence that you can approach on your idea and keep working with one person that has access to 100. I joined associations of the people that I wanted to get into. Veterinary associations, they're looking for speakers. Trucking associations, beer distributor associations, whatever associations. There's MDRT and NAFA associations of our best clients. So I would make one presentation and then get access to 100 people. Wouldn't get them all, but I'd get 2 or 3. And it multiplied my time. Go to one CPA that has 100 clients that need what you do. That's multiplicity of time. Field of 300. This is the easiest way to get into a target market, but it takes about 2 to 3 years to do it. Identify 300 prospects or clients that you want to get into. Get all the information you can about it, what makes them unique, but identify them, and then what you do is you drip market them over the next 2 to 3 years. 25 letters a week with a phone call follow-up. Either you do it or somebody else does it. But 25 a week for 12 weeks is 300. Skip a week, catch up, and all I did, or all my staff does, we sent you a letter, it said XYZ, do you have time to meet with Brian? No. Do you mind? And he always is no. And they say, would you mind if we call back in 3 months to give you a follow-up call? Everybody says no. They know you're not going to call back in 3 months. Then we start the whole process again. 25 calls, 25 follow-up phone calls. You got their second letter, it said XYZ, ABC, do you want to meet with Brian? No. Here's the point. Studies have proven it takes 6 contacts for a cold prospect to become a client. You know it in your junk mail. You get the first one, pitch it. But it's about the 4th, 5th, or 6th one that you get where you notice the logo, you notice the approach, that's where you come back to them. That's how you get into asset management. Put an idea in there, a takeaway, freebie, and just keep pumping it away. I've given this idea out many, many times. It's worked every time that somebody's used it. I've gotten emails back from people, but I don't know how many people have come back and said, well, I did it once or twice. The key is you got to do it for a solid 2 years, and all it costs you is a letter with a stamp. Make it unique. It doesn't have to be creative. I know some people put a dollar bill stapled to it. Some people, I use Zambian Kwacha. You can get them for about 2 cents off the web. It's a beautiful bill. And I've also used the Zimbabwe inflation. I got a $10 trillion note. You can buy it off the internet for $8. We've made copies of it. And you just put it on there and you talk about inflation, whatever. The point is not the letter, it's the follow-up. If you do that 300 times, a year and a half from now, you're going to have probably about 20% of those people as clients. Seminars are always a good way. We've just acquired a firm that does seminars, did a wonderful job with it. We're going to mirror his. I got out of it just simply because we were busy doing everything else, but we're getting back in for the younger advisors. Donut drops. I got my 4 biggest clients from dropping off Dunkin' Donuts to a CPA. And we've got CPAs identified that have big practices in the markets that we want to be in, and we just keep dropping off donuts. and we drop off a packet with the donuts with our card on it that talks about all the different things that we do. Same thing with the drip marketing, but we enclose the donuts to the CPAs. We've got about 14, 15 firms that we work with. Nobody turns away donuts, ever. And here's the neat thing. If you get, like now, I've been doing this for about 15 years. Anybody else that drops off donuts, I get the phone call because they think it's me. Centers of influence, we've all talked about that. And company lunch and learns. I do this a lot with good clients or good centers of influence and say, I know you know what we do. Would you mind bringing two other guys to lunch? We're going to do a quick lunch and learn on an idea I picked up at the Grant Taggart Symposium. Pick an idea and just have your client or your center of influence bring two other people. It's a 35-minute meal. They bring out the lunch. You just talk about the idea for about 2 or 3 minutes. We call them lunch and learns, not prospecting lunches, but lunch and learns. It gets you into the people you want to. Cost of transition, it's a huge hit to revenue. If you're in a sales-based practice up front, it really hits your bottom line until you can make the turn. It took us until about 2005, 2006 before we made the transition on ours. Expenses are higher, short-term, lower long-term. It's easier to service, in our opinion, a recurring revenue practice than it is a sales-based practice. We take 15 clients a year. They come in, it's a big deal, but it's not like I was doing 200 life insurance applications a year. We sell maybe 20, 30 life insurance applications, but our processing time has not been as significant as a sales-based organization. So my overhead's a lot lower and the stress is a lot lower. We use a law firm setup. Name partner, junior advisor, paralegal, staff, support staff. And we use those terms. We use paraplanner. We assign a relationship manager to them. And we use this at all three offices that we deal with. But you don't have to go far to find the model of what you want to do. Just go into a law firm and the one who brings the wisdom with the name on the door, $450, $500 an hour. Junior partner, $150. Use that approach. Partnering with other people. We've acquired firms. As I mentioned this morning in the room, there is a lot of people who either have the desire to simplify their life, and they may have clients that they want to segregate themselves from. They don't want to get out of the business, but they want to segregate themselves from a part of their practice. So if you're younger, looking to team up with somebody, find somebody who's wanting to get out of the 401k business. Or maybe they have an asset management approach. They just want to focus on the life insurance side. Team up with them. Partnering doesn't mean buying out. We just acquired a firm that originally approached me about buying my 401k business. And he's in Chicago. We're in Southern Illinois. I've got about 35 plans. Somebody put us together, and he came in. He wanted to buy my firm, my 401k practice, and I was open to that discussion. A month of negotiation, we flipped that around. I bought all his wealth management practices, and I still have my 401k firm, but we're teaming up, and probably in the next 4 or 5 years, we'll unload that 401k side to him. Plus, they're going to start marketing all the new 401ks. So traditional buyouts don't have to be traditional like it is, but people do want to segregate and simplify their life at a certain time. And look of success. We've invested heavily in the look of success, and the results show it. Again, I debated long and hard about showing revenue numbers. It's not here. We have a lot of expenses that don't go into this slide. But I think it's important to realize where in 2005, we were at about 280,000 of traditional revenue, traditional sales-based practice. 2010, these came right from my broker-dealer. So our life sales, you can see the progression of what happens there. We have some good years and bad years, annuity sales drift on and off, but there's been growth, and you'll see here that the most important part is we were heavy on the sales side of the revenue, and we've cut that in half of a bigger number. So the upfront sales are still there. It's not like you're walking away from them, but that's not the primary focus. And what this gives is a lifestyle choice. I'm gone literally 60% of the time. My young partner works his tail off like I used to do when I was his age, keeping it all together. I invest heavily. He's an MBA. I pay him well. I pay my staff well. They get base salaries and bonuses. And it, well in a small town like Nashville is not the same as well in a big town like Salt Lake City. But you can find good people. And when you hire people, hire smart first and then technical knowledge second. The best thing I did is start hiring smart people that I can train to do what I do. A smart person will learn versus hiring a mediocre person who's a specialist in financial services. If they're coming here, they were mediocre where they were. But if you hire a smart person and then apprentice them internally, give them an apprenticeship program so that they can go from, you know, client relations to paraplanner. Give them a growth path. And then think differently. That was the biggest thing. This is my firm. We built this office. I physically built a lot of it. I don't play golf. I build buildings. And the thing I'm most proud of is that's actually our sign on the street corner. This one right here, I tell people I'm at the corner of work and retire. And they all laugh at it. But when they leave my office, I take a picture of it and I send it to them. Because people don't get that at the Edward Jones office or the Prudential office or any other office but mine. So my encouragement to you, it's not the office that defines you, it's you that define you. And if you want to build up a practice, go to some people, talk to people that have some kind of recurring method. Might be a recurring prospect method. I chose a recurring asset revenue practice. I've tried to be very open with you and share with you a little bit about my firm, and it's really you. And I got two quotes here. Destiny awaits alike for the free man as well as for him enslaved by another man's might. It's your destiny. Choose it. And watch your thoughts, they become words. Watch your words, they become actions. Watch your actions, they become habits. Watch your habits, they become character. And watch your character, it does become your destiny. So thank you very much.